This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At this hour, heavy fighting is underway in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. Explosions shook the city after dark. A U.S. gunship hit targets in the northern part of the city. The AC-130 fired its guns into the Jolan neighborhood. And joining us now on the line from Fallujah is Washington Post reporter Rajiv Chandrasekaran. And thanks very much for being with us.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Can you tell us what's going on there? I know you're on the eastern part of the city. The fighting is apparently in the north. What can you see?
Yeah, things are a little murky on this front right now, but we can hear an AC-130 Spectre gunship. A plane the troops on the ground here have nicknamed Slayer is circling overhead, and we can hear the thudding, sort of like the gonging of a clock, of the 105-millimeter howitzer on this plane. This is a plane that has been doing airstrikes over Fallujah for the past couple of nights. It seems to have been fairly intense here over the past hour. The strikes are, as you had mentioned, in the northern district of Jolan. Now, this is a part of the city that has been fairly problematic for the U.S. Marines. Yesterday, a Marine patrol was ambushed from gunmen hiding in a mosque. There was an initial ambush earlier in the day. Then later in the day, a fierce firefight erupted in which one Marine was killed, eight were wounded, and another eight insurgents were killed. So this has been a particularly troublesome area and the site of regular clashes between Marines who are manning a perimeter around the city and a concentration of insurgents there in the northern area.
Does this look to be something on the scale of what's been happening, those fights over the past few nights in Fallujah?
Yes, you know, even though there's a ceasefire here, Neil, there's been a fair bit of exchange of fire over the past many days. Insurgents of the city have been firing mortars at Marine positions, including the base where I'm at the past couple of nights. There have been some mortars that have impacted nearby. In return, Marine snipers try to shoot at the folks who are firing at them, and occasionally the AC-130 gunship is called in when they have identified targets that are perhaps out of the range of snipers or in areas where their artillery cannot reach.
Now, there had been reports, the U.S. Government leaders, Secretary of State Powell yesterday said the U.S. would give more time for negotiations that are ongoing there in Fallujah. There was a hope that patrols by Iraqi policemen could get underway there today. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, the initial reports that the patrols were supposed to begin today were erroneous. Marines on the ground have always expected these patrols would begin on Thursday. And today, as well as tomorrow, there has been training, and there will be more training tomorrow, of these Iraqi police and civil defense troopers who will accompany the Marines on a patrol. I had an opportunity to attend some of that training today. I saw about 30 Iraqis, a combination of police officers and civil defense members, spending the day training with Marines. They were being educated on safe weapon handling techniques, strategies on how to essentially walk down streets and keep their weapons trained at doors and windows, places where insurgent snipers might be lurking. But the Marines who have been doing the training, Neil, say that the Iraqi security forces, while eager to participate in this process, still are at a very basic level of skill and aren't really at a position where they could be out doing this sort of thing alone. And in fact, the patrols that are supposed to begin on Thursday will be a decidedly one-sided affair. There will be far more Marines than Iraqis. It will be the Marines that will choose the route of the patrol. There will be Marine commanders essentially calling the shots on what will be happening on the ground. The Iraqis will be there just perhaps for a bit of window dressing to give it an Iraqi face.
What are you hearing from both sides, Americans and Iraqis, about participating in these patrols? Obviously, gunfire every night, this is not a safe place.
Indeed, and there's a lot of apprehension. The Iraqis who I spoke to today voiced all different types of sentiments. Some of them expressed eagerness to do this. One senior civil defense official said he hoped the patrols would work because he hoped that they would be a reason for the Americans to exit Fallujah. Now, that doesn't look like it'll happen anytime soon, but there does appear to be sort of a decent amount of camaraderie between the Iraqis and the Americans here. The Marines are also very concerned about this because the people of Fallujah were supposed heavy weapons, and the patrols were supposed to have begun after weapons were turned in under the terms of an April 19th ceasefire. Well, no weapons have really been turned in. There were only 2 days in which weapons were handed over, and the only thing the Marines got were a truckload of antiquated, rusted, inoperable arms, a sack of rusted bullets, about 113 rusty old mortars, and a dozen inert, inoperable rocket-propelled grenades. So the Marines had hoped to be going into the city in a more permissive environment, one where the weapons would be off the streets, or at least more weapons would be off the streets than there are now. They're also concerned that the past few weeks in which there has been this technical ceasefire, at least in which the Marines haven't been engaged in offensive operations, that time has given the insurgents an ability to harden their defenses, to set booby traps, and so that they worry that they might be essentially walking into what could be a very violent engagement.
We're getting reports from the Associated Press that earlier today a U.S. aircraft dropped white leaflets over the city of Fallujah calling on insurgents to surrender. You're surrounded, the leaflets say. If you're a terrorist, beware because your last day was yesterday. In order to spare your life and your end your actions and surrender to coalition forces, now we are coming to arrest you.
Yes, well, these sorts of leaflet drops and psychological operations are a component of the Marine strategy here. And leaflet drops are a regular occurrence. They're also broadcasting similar messages on FM radio stations in Fallujah. And occasionally, Marine psychological operations trucks or PSYOPs vehicles will drive around the edges of the city, blasting out these messages from large loudspeakers on the roof.
And again, before we leave you, it appears, would it be fair to say that it appears right now the fighting that's underway in Fallujah is on the scale of what we've seen the past few nights and not the beginning of a major offensive?
That's correct. It appears that this is, at least from the initial reports we're getting here, something that is perhaps a routine occurrence, or a little bit more than routine, but not the commencement of a new Marine offensive against the city.
Rajiv, thank you very much, and be careful.
Pleasure talking to you, Neil.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran is foreign reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Fallujah in Iraq. Well, for 3 weeks now, American policy in Iraq has focused on the cities not just of Fallujah, but also Najaf, which is to the south of Baghdad. They're very different places that present American commanders with similar problems. Both are home to insurgents, Sunni hardliners in Fallujah, Shia radicals in Najaf. Both have acquired symbolic importance, and both present tests of policy, patience, and resolve. Despite repeated vows to uproot the insurgents, U.S. forces have not pressed the offensive. Despite fierce fighting in or near both cities last night, and as we're hearing again tonight from Fallujah, fragile ceasefires continue to hold. Talks with intermediaries continue. A great deal depends on how these two nettles are resolved. Senior administration officials met with President Bush to discuss the crises over the weekend. Today we'll talk with former administration officials about what's at stake in each city, how and whether the approach may vary, and we'll talk with an Iraqi analyst about the potential consequences. And joining us now to talk about different responses by the U.S. in Fallujah and Najaf and the reasons for them are former administration officials. Lawrence Eagleburger was Secretary of State in the administration of George Bush Sr. He's with us on the line from Charlottesville, Virginia. And Secretary Eagleburger, always good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us is Ashton Carter, an Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy in the first Clinton administration, now co-director of the Harvard-Stanford Preventive Defense Project, located at the Kennedy School of Government. He joins us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here, Neil.
The White House is considering a lot of options, military, political, cultural factors, as it tries to figure out what to do in these two cities. Can you tell us more about these factors? And Secretary Eagleburger, let's begin with you.
Well, the factors, I suppose, are whether the Iraqi reaction to getting really tough in Fallujah, for example, would lead to antagonism toward us. I must say that my own frustration is that we have yelled and thumped our chest for a week now, or 2 weeks now, saying we wouldn't talk any more of this, but we continue to accept a ceasefire. I've believed for a long time that it's more than time that we go in and do the cleaning up of Fallujah and get it done. And apparently the administration, which at one point was saying that they didn't want to accept any ceasefires, now we have the Secretary of State saying he's prepared to give more time to it. I think the longer we wait, and I think the correspondent you had on just a minute ago made the point, the longer we wait, the more difficult it's going to be to clean it up when we finally decide we're going to do so.
Ashton Carter, tell us a little bit about what you think about the situation in Fallujah, and is Najaf a different situation?
Well, they are different. I think how we handle these two uprisings in Fallujah and Najaf is going to spell the difference between containing the violence of to dissident subsets of the Iraqi population and what could turn into a more general uprising. So the stakes couldn't be higher than they are here. The situations in Fallujah and Najaf are quite different strategically, and they do therefore call for different tactics, more of a velvet glove in Najaf, and more, as Secretary Eagleburger has rightly said, of a mailed fist in Fallujah. This is because in Najaf, our goal is to have the Shia community itself isolate and expel Sadr and his militia. And the betting is that they'll do that if we don't intervene too strongly, because they're playing a winning hand. They're going to end up running Iraq. In Fallujah, the mailed fist is more appropriate because the Sunni population there needs to be shown, I think this was Secretary Eagleburger's point, that it cannot restore its old position of dominance through force. And in the tribal way, that must be demonstrated to them with our own show of force.
Yet, Secretary Eagleburger, Fallujah has acquired some symbolic importance as sort of an Iraqi Stalingrad, if you will, the focus of the resistance.
Well, that's all true, but again, the part of the reason for that is because we have not proceeded as quickly and as forcefully as we, I think, should have some time ago, and now we're paying the price for that delay, and as I said, the longer we wait on this, the more difficult it's going to be, and it would seem to me so obvious that we cannot permit the situation in Fallujah to continue if we expect to have any ability to maintain any stability in Iraq. It's going to have to be cleaned up, and therefore I do not understand why we have taken so long to get to this point. In fact, we're not there yet.
And would you agree that there has to be a softer line in Najaf?
Absolutely. Mr. Carter is absolutely correct on this one. That is not to say that we can just sit back and do nothing, but there is no question that al-Sadr is in a way trying to challenge Sistani himself, who is the other leader there, and the fact of the matter is there's some internecine games going on there, and I think we do have to be careful, and I think if we are, hopefully, it will sort itself out, as Mr. Carter said.
When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue talking with former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger and former Assistant Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter. If you'd like to join our conversation and discuss the options for U.S. leadership in Najaf and Fallujah, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll also be speaking with an Iraqi analyst about the possible outcomes and how they may affect the future in Iraq. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the flashpoint Iraqi cities of Fallujah and Najaf and different U.S. approaches to deal with insurgents and the different kinds of insurgents that have taken refuge in both those cities. Our guests are Lawrence Eagleburger, Secretary of State during the administration of George Bush I, and Ashton Carter, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the first Clinton administration. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or email us TOTN at NPR.org. And I wanted to ask, both of you have been in the room when tough decisions are made at the White House. Can you give us an idea of the situation that might have been seen at Camp David over the weekend when President Bush and his advisors met to talk about the various options they might pursue? Ashton Carter?
Well, I think the thing that they must be most sensitive to is whether our understanding of the situation is sound or not. You know, what understanding a society in turmoil and transition is hard under the best of circumstances, and I think even Iraqis don't fully understand what is going on in their country. So I'm sure in Washington they're very sensitive to how solid their understanding of these two very different, as I've described them, and I think they are, situations are. I think, first of all, they're listening to the military commanders, not just because those commanders can give the best tactical advice, that's their profession, but because their assessment of the situation on the ground is probably the best you can get. It turns out our military is more out and about in Iraq today than are the civilians in the Coalition Provisional Authority, because it's not safe for those civilians to come out of their compounds. And so the military is the closest to the situation and probably has the best feel for what's actually going on. Against that feel, of course, back in Washington, you have to balance those views of those commanders, which is understandably very short-term, very tactical. They have people to protect. They have engagements they're involved in. Against the strategic views I described earlier, that is, we are up to a fundamentally different game with the Sunnis, who are, in a sense, the losers in the future of Iraq, and the Shias, who are going to inherit the future in Iraq. And we need to make sure that our tactics reflect our strategy. So, for example, were we to use excessive force in Najaf, that would undercut. It may be effective in the near term, but it would undercut our long-term strategy of winning over the Shias. And were we, and this is a point we were making earlier, to inclined to negotiate with dissidents in the Sunni regions, I think that would be interpreted in that society as a sign of weakness and would undermine our long-term strategy there, which is to demonstrate to the Sunnis that they're no longer running the whole place. So I would be concerned in Washington, is the understanding we think we have really correct or not?
Would it be Eagleburger, would it be weakness or patience, wisdom, perhaps?
Well, I don't disagree with anything that was said. I think this would all be under consideration. At some point, some decisions have to be made on the longer-term aspects of all of these questions. Basically, I mean by that, if we don't get these things settled, what are the consequences? If we do, and again, there's the difference between the two cities, but one of the things that it seems to me is essential is that, and it gets back to this question of understanding the society in which we now find ourselves, and one of the questions it would seem to me has to be a recognition, not a question, but a recognition rather, that the Iraqi people have been pushed and pulled and banged around for many, many decades now, and one of the things I think we ought to recognize is that they're going to stay neutral, or with their heads down at least, until they see whether we are intent on winning this thing. And under those circumstances, again, I think it's terribly important, particularly in the case of the first city, it's terribly important that we make it clear that we intend to win it. And one of the problems I think we see, and probably one of the problems that is a consequence of the attempt to consider all of these different factors, is that there has been no clear decision on what to do yet. And under those circumstances, I think we send a difficult message at best to the Iraqis, who aren't sure how long we're going to be there and how serious we're going to be.
Let's get a caller on the line, and Mike is with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I wonder why anybody would expect the insurgents to disarm when everybody knows what happened to the nation of Iraq when it complied with the United Nations resolution to disarm?
Well, Secretary Eagleburger...
not only that, but when they send garbage in the way of weapons that don't work and so forth in the first supposed attempt to demonstrate that they wanted to agree with a ceasefire, I don't know why we believe one thing they do. So anyway, if I read the caller right, we have had a great deal of evidence about the meanings of these people when they agree to do things. So I think we should have expected all along that this was not going to get better. It was going to get worse.
I think the Secretary misses my point.
Yes.
No, I know what your point is, and I was trying to miss it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thanks for the call, Micah. But Ashton Carter, again, what is in it for the insurgents in either of these two places to surrender? There's a murder warrant out for Muqtada al-Sadr in Jaffan. The people in Fallujah have presumably been identified, a lot of them by video pictures. They're going to face serious consequences.
Well, all true, but remember, our objective is not to redeem the insurgents. Our objective is to make sure that their popularity remains limited, they remain isolated, the rest of the population doesn't have any sympathy for them. That means, once again, in Fallujah, proving that to them and to the population that that kind of uprising can't succeed. And in the Shia South, giving the rest of the Shia population the time to expel the Sadr militias from the cities, and there's some evidence that they're willing to do that. Then in the next phase, once you, if as I certainly hope, these organized uprisings are put down, the next step is to ensure a more mundane kind of order in Iraq. What's ultimately going to lose the Iraqi people's confidence in their future and therefore in what we've done there is if they can't walk down the streets without being stuck up, if they can't open their shops without the shops being looted. And so there's a more mundane kind of security that has to be restored after this kind of security has been restored, because there can be no reconstruction in Iraq without security.
If I may, let me say, it seems to me that the Fallujah issue is far more immediately important, and it will have an impact, I think, on the later solution to the al-Sadr's problem. And that is, if we show we're intent on getting this thing done, I think it will make it clear to a great many Iraqis who aren't sure at this stage that, in fact, getting to Mr. Carter's second point, which is that after all of this, there can be some peace and tranquility, and they can walk down the streets. It would seem to me this all, to a great degree, hinges on what we do now with regard to Fallujah.
Let's get one more caller in. This is Lois from Brookings, South Dakota.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you. I have a question. I would like to know why we don't seem to understand that violence is never a permanent solution, and I would like to see more of a diplomatic response to restore peace.
Secretary Eagleburger, you're a diplomat. Is diplomacy appropriate in this situation?
I've heard this for so long, and my question is, what's your definition of diplomacy? Is it a bunch of people sitting around a table talking to each other and trying to reach compromise or whatever?
No.
And certainly that's appropriate many times. However, I must tell you that in a situation like this, if your diplomacy is not backed by a threat of the use of force, it is not going to succeed when you're dealing with the kinds of people we're dealing with here. They don't have these concerns about using force that we have too often, it seems to me, and they don't care about it. And under those circumstances, you have to answer them, to some degree at least, in their own coin.
Lois, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
And our guests have to leave us, and we thank them for their time today. Lawrence Eagleburger, Secretary of State in the administration of the first President Bush. He's on the line with us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Ashton Carter, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the first Clinton administration, now co-director of the Harvard-Stanford Preventive Defense Project, and he was with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
And now to get an Iraqi view of the U.S. tactics in Fallujah and Najaf, joining Joining us now from his office here in Washington is Laith Kuba, president of the Iraqi National Group. That's an Iraqi think tank based in Washington. Before the war, he was a spokesman for the Iraqi National Congress, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
First of all, I wanted to ask you a question of some news that came up yesterday. When Secretary Powell and other American officials have talked about the transfer of power in Iraq after June the 30th, and now they're talking about limited sovereignty, certainly in terms of security forces. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it's not clear. I understand sovereignty as one whole thing, but at the same time, I do understand the difficulty of leaving the security question unanswered. Iraq has no army, no intelligence, no police. There is over 150,000 foreign troops in Iraq. There must be a way of regulating this. It's unlikely that the new government on the 1st of July will sign a security agreement from day one that will answer all the questions. But I would have thought some formula might be worked out. But I do not comprehend how sovereignty can be limited other than for the UN to retain that sovereignty and pass over to the Iraqi government a limited mandate to run the country.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting on to the situation that we've been talking about today, I know you've been in contact with Iraqis inside Fallujah and Najaf. What are they saying about what's been going on in both those places?
Well, without question, the situation has become complicated indeed. In Fallujah, I think over the last few months, we could not differentiate two issues. There is a Sunni issue, which is a political one, that they need to be included in the process. They must feel they have some room in Iraq's in the future of Iraq, and they must not be threatened. Basically, they must not be the scapegoat for Iraq. But on the other hand, there is another element which is not a political one, and that is purely to do with network of terrorists, some Al-Qaeda-like, some are local, some may be remnants of Saddam, who have shielded and sheltered themselves in Fallujah. And I would have thought the last thing you want to do by threatening the whole city, you are actually cementing them together and making it far more difficult to address the issue. I would have thought the strategy should have been to differentiate the two and hit hard only at the networks, not the whole city. Once we lose the population, it's very, very difficult to address these issues.
What about the situation in Najaf?
The situation in Najaf is fundamentally different. A, it was totally uncalled for. I think by and large, the Shias have not been hostile to the coalition. As you know, they occupy all cities from Baghdad to Basra. I think it was a mistake to have picked up a fight with Muqtada Sadr. He was an irrelevant small leader. As unpleasant as he might be, he would have not been in a position to undermine the transition. Having focused on him now and made him more or less like a local hero, and he became a symbol, a rallying point for so many people, I think picking up a fight with him is in Najaf is going to open up not only Najaf, but other cities throughout Iraq. This is a fight totally uncalled for. We got nothing to gain out of it, and it could have been postponed to the day when the Iraqi government would have had its own police, its own army, and would have handled and dealt with him and his men locally.
We're speaking with Laith Kuba of the Iraqi National Group, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I know you were listening when Secretary Eagleburger and Ashton Carter were talking to us about U.S. tactics, particularly in terms of Fallujah. What do you think the United States should do now?
Well, it's, as I said, very unfortunate now we're locked into this position. But I know one thing for sure, that escalation will make all of us losers. The U.S. will lose out on it because the U.S., the America's objective is to have a successful transition, not to pick up a fight and demolish the Sunnis in Iraq or pick up a fight with the Shias. These are not our objectives. These are sidetrack issues that others want us to fall into. I think we must stay focused on the objective, and that is to create a climate where we make that transition possible. Those who want to pick up a fight now, I think so long as they do not affect the transition, we need not bother too much about it. So my recommendation would be maybe to stay put and certainly not to escalate. It's extremely difficult to climb down now because it would be seen as weakening of America's position and a retreat, but certainly not to escalate.
But if there's no escalation, if the insurgents are not cleaned out of Fallujah, that would presumably be developed as a sort of no-go zone, a free area for them.
Well, as I said, it's as unfortunate as it sounds, there are no good options here. Ideally, one would have won the local population in Fallujah one way or the other. When there were some mediation and some people going back and forth opening channels, maybe what one would have given them a little bit more to open up and win as many insiders as possible. Not everybody in Fallujah is an enemy. I think the strategy should have been to isolate those few. I don't know, they might be hundreds or might be a thousand or two, but nothing more than that. But to go after a city with 250,000 or 500,000 people with their extended tribes and families, it's really going to be extremely costly. We must always ask the question, to what end, at what cost? And we must keep our eye focused on transition. That is the objective.
In Najaf, many people have said, and our earlier guests sort of agreed with it, that the challenge of Muqtadir al-Sadr is really not so much toward the United States, but really towards the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, and perhaps the other Shia leaders in Najaf are much better suited to deal with al-Sadr than American forces.
Well, surely there are differences, important differences, between Muqtada Sadr and the more traditional quietist Ayatollahs who are in Najaf. When Saddam was kicked out of power, in the early days, Muqtada Sadr was very much a name. People who supported him were all over the place. But we've noticed over the past few months, he diminished and nobody really noticed him, and Sistani rose to prominence. It's only recently, after this crisis, he now back again on the stage, being the center of attention, and he's not bothered if he is killed or not killed. I think we must not give him that wish of making him a martyr and having a big problem on our hands. I think he could have been, and I still believe he can be, contained now, but we need to handle this slowly. The issues that were raised against him are not threatening. He is accused or being implicated in a murder a year ago. Well, that's not a make-or-break issue for Iraq. Certainly, the law courts can look into this in the future, this amongst many, many other issues. So I think whoever advised or judged this issue has been misled, or the intelligence has maybe been as bad as intelligence on other issues. People have miscalculated that move.
We'll continue speaking with Laith Kuba after a short break, and we'll take more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now, we're finishing our discussion about how Iraqis view the different U.S. strategies for the besieged cities of Fallujah and Najaf. Our guest is Laith Kuba, president of the Iraqi National Group, a former spokesman for the Iraqi National Congress. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Greg. Greg joins us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd just like to ask, what is the population of Fallujah and the population of Najaf? And of the civilians that live there, what is the level of support, possibly percentage-wise, for the American troops and the other allied troops that are there?
If I may say, I think in Fallujah, the city has over 300,000 people, and if you were to include their extended, like, tribal kinship and family, you're talking about 500,000, very much in Fallujah and its immediate surroundings. In Najaf and the neighborhoods around Najaf, you're talking about 750,000 in total. The terms in Najaf, without question, the support, I would say there is no opposition to the American presence, but that does not necessarily mean there is support. there is a passive attitude of wait and see. In Fallujah, I have met many people from Fallujah, both inside Iraq when I was there, and I've met them on my many trips to Jordan. Many of them would like to reach an accommodation, turn a page, and would like to be included in the political process. I have not sensed that they want to go back to the days of Saddam Hussein. There is a lot of apprehension about being all dragged into this fight. So I would say, while in Fallujah, many people resent the Americans, and I would say hundreds, if not thousands, a few thousands, a thousand or two at the most, are prepared to fight them. But by and large, the majority of people want to get on with their lives.
Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go now to John, and John's on the line from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, my question is, if there are 500,000 people in Fallujah and there are a couple of thousand terrorists, what is the role of the Iraqi residents in evicting these people? Is it only our responsibility as Americans to make this all right, or is there some local responsibility?
Without question, the responsibility falls mainly on the Iraqis at large, not only on the local residents in Fallujah. It is with deep regret that Iraqis are not united. They are divided. And some, well, mainly leaders among Shias and Kurds who suffered so much under Saddam Hussein, see an opportunity to hit back on people in Fallujah who were very much supporters of Saddam Hussein, serving in the army and in the intelligence and other agencies. So this didn't help. I would have thought this domestic politics should have been handled with a lot of care. The U.S. should have not been dragged to include some and exclude others. Of course, I don't believe this was done intentionally, but this is the way it was perceived. And I would have thought the way to engage those millions, thousands of people in Fallujah to work with you is to work more on engaging them politically. They were very isolated. They were totally gone from the days they were really prominent in power to the days nobody wants to talk to them. They've lost their jobs. Their cities are surrounded, and there is no way to engage them.
John, thank you.
Thank you.
If Fallujah is, there is eventually an assault on Fallujah and their problem is resolved militarily in Fallujah, do you think, as some have said, that there could be similar kinds of problems in other Iraqi cities in the Sunni Triangle area, places like Ramadi?
Not immediately. I think what would happen, and there is no question that the U.S. has the muscle to flatten Fallujah, but that is not going to flatten the terrorism or the resistance, and it's not going to pave the way for a smoother political transition. In fact, if anything, it is going to make the transition far more difficult. For a simple reason, these are complex issues that cannot be simply addressed by force alone. Nobody ever questioned that the U.S. can defeat Saddam Hussein and his army in Iraq. The big question has always been what to do on the day after and how to manage. And nobody would question now that the U.S. can move in Fallujah and basically flatten whoever is in their way. But the question, what do you do on the day after? How are you going to pick up the political pieces and put it back again into a meaningful way?
And talk to us, if you would, about the symbolic importance of these two cities to Iraqis, and of course, to the Shia community. The city of Najaf is very holy indeed.
Well, as far as Najaf is concerned, it is beyond imagination that the coalition would commit such a mistake and try to move into Najaf. This would hit deep not only throughout the Shia community in Iraq, but I think throughout Shia communities worldwide. It would be very much, it would be a catastrophic mistake to try to move into Najaf. This is beyond, as I said, I don't believe anybody can come up with that recommendation. With Fallujah, it's not a holy city, it's not an historical city, it has become, to some, in fact, it's a symbol of a Saddam loyalist city. to others, it has become a city that resisted the occupation. So it's going to play mainly amongst the Sunnis. Maybe, if there is another front opened up with the Shias, then it will rise to prominence as a city that resisted the occupation. But with Fallujah, as I said, it's not the symbolic cost. It's actually crushing it by force would mean losing the Sunnis for good and not engaging them in the political process.
Let's get another caller on the line, and we'll talk now with Cynthia, and she's with us from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm a former Marine. I spent 10 years in the United States Marine Corps, and I can tell you that I speak for not only other Marines, but also a lot of veterans, and we're disgusted. We're disgusted with the way Fallujah is being handled. We really feel like martial law and a lot of heavy artillery fire are the way to handle the problem over there in Fallujah. We are just disgusted. We are seeing our lives and our tax dollars being wasted there. I think that diplomacy is not an option, especially not in Fallujah. I think that the use of military force, flattening the city, as your guest says, I think is a pretty much the consensus amongst veterans such as myself.
Well, I did not actually suggest that you'd flatten the city. I think what I said, this is very much within arms, within the ability of the U.S. Army to do. But we must always ask to what end. Nobody questions the U.S. might. I think what is in question is the plan. To what end? Is this an open-ended war, or does it have a clear end and we're following a specific plan?
I think what Cynthia and perhaps some others are saying is there are Marines and other people taking casualties on the lines in Fallujah every night while these negotiations appear to get nowhere and ambushes and mortar attacks continue every day. The situation can't last forever.
I mean, as I said, it's a difficult position we ended up in. I cannot agree more, but I don't believe that simply more use of force is going to make life any easier. An alternative, while the security issues need to be addressed fully, while the U.S. Army need to be protected, Marines must not be put in that position in the first place. While taking all this in consideration, I look at the big picture to see where are we heading. And to me, what concerns me more is we might end up taking more casualties if we simply keep on and on a path that has not well thought through.
Cynthia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Laith Kuba, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Laith Kuba, president of the Iraqi National Group, director of the Middle East Program at the National Endowment for Democracy. He spoke to us from his office here in Washington. We were not able to make contact to talk to you about the story about the Italian hostages and reaction in Italy to that. We will try to bring you that later on in Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.